Welcome to Untangled, a show from WOSU and All Sides where we take a complicated topic and untangle it for you. Pull it apart and weave the facts back together in ways that are easy to understand. This season, we're untangling immigration, from the kinds of immigrants who live here in Ohio to how the immigration court up in Cleveland operates. We've traveled through 100 years of immigration law and explored why our asylum laws are responsible for the current border crisis. Today, we're tackling misinformation. This is episode 5, Separating Immigration Fact from Fiction. Immigration has been the most hotly debated issue in America since Donald Trump first came down that golden escalator to run for president, launching his campaign with a speech about immigration.
They're bringing drugs, they're bringing crime, they're rapists, and some, I assume, are good people.
And then at the presidential debate just last week, he said this.
We had the safest border in the history of our country. The border, all he had to do was leave it. All he had to do was leave it. He decided to open up our border, open up our country to people that are from prisons, people that are from mental institutions, insane asylum, terrorists. We have the largest number of terrorists coming into our country right now, all terrorists, all over the world, not just in South America, all over the world. They come from the Middle East, everywhere, all over the world, they're pouring in. And this guy just left it open. And he didn't need legislation because I didn't have legislation. I said, close the border. We had the safest border in history. In that final couple of months of my presidency, we had, according to Border Patrol, who is great, and by the way, who endorsed me for president, but I won't say that, but they endorsed me for president. Brandon, just speak to him. But look, we had the safest border in history. Now we have the worst border in history. There's never been anything like it. And people are dying all over the place, including the people that are coming up in caravans.
Thank you, President Trump.
Trump makes a lot of claims about immigrants, but so do most politicians. And there are conflicting economic studies, researchers, advocates. It can be hard to tell who is telling the truth, which is why we begin this hour dedicated to misinformation at the U.S.-Mexico border. Joining me now is Ohio Capital Journal reporter Marty Schladen. He covers border issues for the news outlet, and he's actually at the border right now. Marty, welcome to Untangled.
Good morning, Anna. How are you?
Good. Where are you?
I'm in El Paso right now. Beautiful El Paso, Texas, on the border that's supposedly so violent.
And how many trips have you taken down there in recent months?
Well, this is my second time this year. As you know, I used to work for the El Paso Times for 7 years. Between 2010 and 2013, I lived here. And then for the next 4 years, I was the Times' guy in Austin.
So you've spent a lot of time at the U.S.-Mexico border.
That's correct.
So can you tell us what it's like today walking around in El Paso?
It's totally peaceful the way it always is. This is a myth that really rankles people here. El Paso is a very safe city. It consistently ranks among the safest large cities in the United States. It's safer than Columbus, Cleveland, Cincinnati, Dayton. It's safer than all of them.
A couple months ago, you wrote about Sundland Park, New Mexico, which is pretty close to El Paso. And you wrote about a businessman who watches coyotes smuggle people across the border from his restaurant and resort. Can you tell us a little bit about what's happening over in Sundland Park?
It's slowed down now. The man's name is Robert Artavino, and he's a really interesting guy. And his place is Artavino's Desert Crossing. It's really cool. It's retro. But where he is right in the corner where Texas, New Mexico, and Mexico come together. There's a mountain there called Cristo Rey. It's got a cross at the top of it. People do a pilgrimage up there every Easter. But on the backside of it is Mexico. And the coyotes bring people over that mountain and down into Robert's parking lot. And this has been especially like
literally in the parking lot of his restaurant.
Literally in the parking lot of his restaurant. Sometimes those guys hang out in his bar. He's had a problem with that. So it's been a real issue for him. It's important to not act like this isn't a problem. But what Robert says is it's not the problem people up in Ohio think it is.
Right. Do the residents in that region have more of an issue with the smugglers or the people being smuggled? Because this is the really the crux of the question.
And he says it's the smugglers. These are the same dirt bags that, you know, belong to cartels. They are they're parasites. They take advantage of people who have no power. And they're the ones, they're stealing cars, they're doing a lot of stuff that are a big, that it's a big problem, according to Robert.
Yeah, and they're the ones sitting in his bar waiting for the people to come across the border.
That's correct. And it, for a business owner like him, it creates this impossible situation. He doesn't want to confront them in his bar. He's worried about and it's a restaurant too, but he's got patrons to worry about. He's got employees to worry about. This is, you know, just an untenable situation for him.
Yeah, you had this quote in the article that you wrote about him where you said, instead of making life harder for migrants, as Texas authorities are, Artovino said law enforcement should focus like a laser on their smugglers.
That's correct. You know, because one thing you have to understand about the border is everybody, almost everybody, has family on both sides of it. You know, they're from the United States, they're from Mexico, but they're also from the border. And there's a good deal of sympathy for people who've just come to this country because their lives are so bad where they're coming from. And Robert totally believes in that. But then you've got the criminals, and he doesn't believe in them at all.
Border crossings hit a historic high in December, but so did migrant deaths. 148 people died in El Paso's Border Patrol sector in fiscal year 2023. That was double what it was the year before. And before 2022, the sector recorded as few as one, but no more than 40 deaths each year, dating all the way back to 1998. So it sounds like the border crossing is not necessarily getting more dangerous, but just statistically, as more people come, more people die.
Well, I think it's more dangerous, too. And that's an intentional thing by Texas Governor Greg Abbott. He's stretched miles of razor wire across stretches of the border. They put in floats that have netting in the river where it's deep enough you have to swim through. They've got netting below the floats. They've got basically saw blades between the floats, and people are getting cut up and dying that way too. So it's also more dangerous, but it, like you say, it's more people as well.
And I should say last summer was the hottest summer on record in El Paso, with long streaks of triple digit days. And oftentimes, as we are seeing, migrants who are crossing are not necessarily from Central America. We've seen a real uptick in crossings from people all over the world, some of whom may not quite understand what it means to cross a desert in a series of 100-degree days.
That's correct. I was just at a conference in New York City where this was discussed. They call them intercontinental migrants. And yes, if you're coming from China, you don't understand this. A lot of them have gone through the Darien Gap between South America and Central America, which is also super dangerous. But it's important for people to understand how hazardous this journey is and how hot the desert is in the dead of summer.
Yeah, the Darien Gap is another incredibly dangerous crossing in Central America. And I do think that is something that gets lost sometimes in this conversation, is that walking couple hundred or even 1,000 miles through deserts and across mountains and into jungles, it's not an easy trek.
Not at all, Anna. In fact, last year I was down here when there was a large amount of migrants in El Paso, and I interviewed them. And the ones who came through the Darien Gap, they all saw people die. They saw every kind of outrage. You know, you've got the natural hazards, the heat and all those things. But then there are predators who take advantage of them because they're totally vulnerable. And what these people have been through is probably unimaginable to you and me and everybody listening right now.
I want to talk about the surge in people crossing the border, particularly in 2023. And I want to circle back to what the clip that I played earlier of former President Donald Trump, because he talks about how in the final few months of his presidency, we had some of the lowest border crossings on record. And that was the fall of 2020. And I was hoping you could help us understand Title 42 and the health restrictions during COVID.
So Title 42 was used to say that we couldn't have people coming into the country and claiming asylum and being allowed to stay in the country while they waited for hearings because they posed at risk of bringing COVID with them. So what people did was they showed up at the border and they were told you're going to have to wait in Mexico. And that was Title 42. People were also, it's important to remember too, that COVID racked Latin America in ways that we didn't see. So I think fewer people were migrating. The people who were migrating were being sent back to Mexico. When Biden became president, he stretched out Title 42 as long as he could. And that reduced numbers crossing the border.
Until about March, April of 2022, this order was in place. And one of the things I found fascinating was, depending on whether it was Trump or Biden or different moments in COVID surges, it kept 50 to 75% of the people trying to cross the border. It turned 50 to 75% away. So eventually we end Title 42, and then we see this surge of people coming. Do you think some of it is all those people that were waiting all those years?
I think that's true. And I think it's also true that, you know, word on the street in the places people are coming from was influenced by that. I was at a dinner party here in El Paso last night, and the host was telling me that, you know, if word gets around in Guatemala or whatever place that it's no good, you don't want to make this trip just to get turned back right at the border, people don't come. But then word gets out that Title 42 has been repealed or whatever, more people come.
So then do you think there's truth to the argument that because President Trump was so aggressive in turning people away, trying to get people to wait in Mexico, separating families at the border, that it did dampen the number of people trying to cross?
I think there's probably some truth to that, but I need to couch that by saying almost nothing that the former president said during the debate was true. But I do think that, you know, saying scary things did scare some people away.
I will say that coming up in the next segment, we're talking with a data scientist, and we're going to walk through those questions about how often migrants commit crimes here in the United States. We're definitely getting to that in just a few moments. But what do you think, as somebody who's lived at the border and somebody who regularly visits the border, what do you think people here in Ohio don't understand? Or what is one thing you'd like them to think about?
I think when I worked at the El Paso Times, one of the things we said in the newsroom was every mile farther from the border somebody gets, the more of an expert he thinks he is in border security. El Paso is a totally safe place. It's been proven migrants commit less crime than the native born. El Paso is not a war zone. And the rest of the borders, actually, these communities are safer than other communities are. And people need to understand this because these myths to the contrary really hurt these communities. People are afraid to come, and they're full of, you know, really wonderful people. And that's the thing I think people need to know.
And it's a really, in some places, particularly in that New Mexico area, it's a really beautiful part of the country.
Oh my gosh, it's unbelievable. If you know, I grew up in the Midwest and I'm used to everything being green and, you know, beautiful in its way. But then I got out here and, like you say, Anna, it's just breathtaking.
That was Ohio Capital Journal reporter Marty Schladen down in El Paso, Texas. Thank you for your time this morning.
Thanks, Anna.
Coming up, we're deep diving into that data on who commits crimes here in the United States with a person who studies immigration enforcement. That's when Untangled continues on 89.7 NPR News.
At Shortwave Space Camp, we escape our everyday lives to explore the mysteries and quirks of the universe. We find weird, fun, interesting stories that explain how the cosmos is partying all around us. From stars to dwarf planets to black holes and beyond, we've got you. Listen now to the Shortwave podcast from NPR.
You're listening to Untangled, a show from All Sides and WOSU that takes a complicated topic and untangles it for you. I'm your host, Anna Staver. We're separating immigration fact from fiction this hour. And one of the biggest questions that came up during the presidential debate last week is whether the people crossing the border are committing crimes.
We are living right now in a rat's nest. They're killing our people in New York, in California, in every state in the union, because we don't have borders anymore. Every state is now a border. And because of his ridiculous, insane, and very stupid policies, people are coming in and they're killing our citizens at a level that we've never seen. We call it migrant crime. I call it Biden migrant crime.
President Joe Biden flatly disagreed, saying the only terrorists to cross our border did so while Trump was president.
The only terrorist who's done anything crossing the border is one who came along and killed three under his administration, killed an Al-Qaeda person, come in his administration, killed three American soldiers, killed three American soldiers. That's the only terrorist that's there. I'm not saying that no terrorist ever got through, but the idea they're emptying their prisons, we're welcoming these people, that's simply not true. There's no data to support what he said. Once again, he's exaggerating, he's lying.
Joining me now to untangle how migrants actually interact with our judicial system is Austin Coker. He's a geographer at Syracuse University, where he studies immigration enforcement using large government data sets. He also helps manage Syracuse's Transactional Records Access Clearinghouse, or TRAC, which is a font of information for anyone looking to lose a couple of hours in immigration data. Welcome to Untangled, Austin.
Thanks for having me.
It's true that immigrants commit crimes in America. It's also true that of those who commit crimes, some are here legally and some are here illegally. The real question is, what kinds of crimes do they commit and how often are they committing them? Your most recent data at TRAC shows that in June 2024, about 60% of ICE detainees have no criminal record. Has that been the case historically, that the majority of people that get picked up by customs enforcement have no prior criminal record?
That is generally true. It depends a little bit on which agency is doing the arresting. For those immigrants who are in immigrant detention today, a little bit less than 40,000, some percentage of those are picked up by Customs and Border Protection officers along the border. And for people who are recently arriving, either through ports of entry or crossing between ports of entry, they probably haven't been in the country long enough to have had much contact with the criminal justice system. So those tend to be much lower, whereas immigrants who are arrested by ICE, Immigration Customs Enforcement, tend to show higher rates of criminal convictions on their records. But across the board, combining both of, arrests from both of those agencies, the numbers tend to not be that high. So that percentage that you mentioned that we posted recently, fairly consistent over time.
The data also shows that despite the rising number of detainees, and the number of detainees is going up, the number of people convicted of a crime is holding steady or dropping in some cases, which I found really fascinating. So we are arresting more migrants than ever before.
That's right. The numbers have really fluctuated over the past couple of years. And one of the important things to understand about this sort of part of the immigration system, when we look at detention specifically, is that, as I mentioned, it's in part driven by these days, the border, but we've seen fluctuations in these numbers because of policies at the, you know, the administration level, from Obama to Trump to Biden. Overall, the detention numbers were highest under President Trump and then declined pretty dramatically. Actually, declined a little bit before the pandemic, but then really declined dramatically during the pandemic. We're still in this period of detention growth. So the numbers have stayed around 40,000 over the past several years. There's other ways too of looking at sort of people's criminal history. Certainly looking at detention is one. We can look at kind of other areas of the system. We can see how many immigrants who are facing deportation in court, for instance, have criminal convictions. We can also look at people who have been deported, which is actually a really good indicator because it kind of shows you the other side of the system. We can look at criminal convictions there. And again, across the board, it's certainly not the case that there's that immigrants never have criminal records, but it tends to be pretty low.
I want to talk about those with criminal convictions. Sure. In the TRAC system, because you do look at those. So if you're up for an asylum case, if you're interacting with an immigration court, they're going to look at your criminal record. That's going to be one of the factors that determines whether you get asylum. And you guys break them down into three different levels based on the severity of the crime. So level three is actually the lowest level. And about half of those with a conviction fall in this category. And they have things like traffic offenses, illegal entry, and driving under the influence.
Yeah, that's right. Those tend to be the kinds of things that we see formally listed on people's records. Those are important partly because, so some of those are immigration specific offenses and some of those are other kinds of, you know, crimes of different kinds. It is sort of important, I think, one of the major distinctions that we make that the government has made and other folks have made over the years is sort of the difference between people whose the extent of their crime is immigration related. So typically either, let's say, overstaying a visa or crossing into the United States illegally. While important, obviously, to immigration enforcement, we tend to follow the lead historically of sort of separating those out and making a little bit of a distinction, since immigration specific violations have not historically really been considered, sort of been considered victimless crimes. I mean, if someone crosses illegally into the United States, it's not necessarily in itself something like assault or one of these other crimes that people tend to think of. So we tend to separate those out, and certainly driving without a license in some places, DUI, other kinds of traffic infractions tend to form a fairly high a number of immigrants in court with convictions on their record. And part of that is that a lot of immigration enforcement takes place inside the United States connected to traffic enforcement. So for a lot of immigrants who have an experience, you know, have an interaction with law enforcement, it might be around traffic just because of the nature of criminal enforcement within the United States.
Yeah, that's one of the conversations happening at the state level, whether to allow people who've come into the country illegally to obtain a like driver's license or some sort of identification, allow them to get insurance for a vehicle. People are very twisted up over whether that's a good thing or a bad thing.
For sure. It's, you know, and I can understand that people have different perspectives on this. You know, driver's licenses and driving law is a state level. That's, you know, state law. It's been complicated, obviously, in the past decade and a half because state IDs have become very much wrapped up in sort of the pursuit of the federal government to sort of strengthen identification laws. And so I can see why some people may not want to do that. On the other hand, in fact, some people are even have expressed concerns about the fact that it could actually increase the risk for migrants because their information is then being put into a database. But, you know, the other side of the argument that I've heard interviewing, you know, people about this and even law enforcement who has sometimes quite divided opinions on this is that actually, like many things, registering people to drive who are going to drive anyway and making sure that they have access to insurance is sort of the best way to protect everyone. So sort of an insurance model of traffic, and that would, in some cases, you know, by some arguments, make the road safer.
The next level up that you guys track for criminal cases is a level two, and that's about 12 to 15% of those with a criminal conviction who are working their way through the immigration court system. I did want to ask, so illegal entry is considered level three, but illegal re-entry is a level two, and it's up there with larceny and weapons offenses. Why is illegal reentry so much worse?
Certainly. So just a quick context. So the categorization that we use for that is something we follow that the Department of Homeland Security came up with. All of the data that we get is directly from federal agencies, and we tend to follow their cue in terms of how they understand the data in terms of categorization. So that's sort of their classification and has been in the past. The reason that those things are separated out is, at least currently under immigration law, unlawful entry, what we call 1325, section 1325 of Title 8 of the U.S. Code, which governs immigration, is a misdemeanor. So crossing the first time is a misdemeanor. Unlawful reentry is a felony. And so that's why those two things are separated out.
And then finally, level one is the most serious offenses. And it includes things like assault, burglary, drug trafficking, sex crimes. These are the worst of the worst cases.
Yeah, that's right. Those are the kinds of crimes that it's a complicated conversation around crime and immigration, but those are tend to be the crimes that that most people find sort of most concerning and tend to be less controversial in terms of, you know, what are the consequences? Is this really a serious crime or not? I think there's been debates over the years about whether a minor traffic infraction should force a mother or a father with kids in the United States to be deported, whether or not that's a sort of an adequate response to that. But some of the more serious crimes, I think, you know, tend to be less controversial. Although I still think there's a strong argument to be made. And my colleague Cesar at Ohio State University there, in fact, has made it in a recent book called Welcoming the Wretched, where he says, in fact, any crime, we should really think about whether the proper remedy for society, for families, for communities is simply deportation, as if simply sort of ejecting someone from the country solves the root cause of any crime. And I think that's an important argument to consider.
One of the things that surprised me was the percentage of people who have a drug trafficking crime on their record, because we hear a lot of talk about bringing fentanyl across the border, about bringing drugs across the border. And yes, absolutely, that is one of the main ways drugs get into our country. But it seems like a lot of the drugs are moving with very few people. Does that make sense? That's at least what the data seems to suggest.
Absolutely. It's not a very common offense, at least within any of the data that the government records that we get. You know, I was just reviewing before our conversation, looking at deportations. I know we haven't talked about the data on deportations, but I just want to flag it just because, you know, looking at detention and looking at the courts, those provide really important perspectives at people's criminal records at different points in the process. But deportations is sort of important because, you know, as I mentioned before, in detention, there's a lot of people who are sort of recently arrived. So one can make the argument and say, well, actually, because so many people are new to the country, of course, they're not going to have criminal convictions yet. That doesn't really reflect reality. One way to sort of flesh out that picture then is to say, okay, let's look at people who have been all the way through the deportation process and have been, or, you know, the legal process, and have been deported, effectively deported by the government. Let's look at that point, because those records are probably most likely to be the most thorough. If something else would have come up in court, at some point it would have been likely added to the documentation. And so what we see there is, the based on deportations from October, you know, basically for the first 5 months of the fiscal year, so October 2023 to the end of February 2024, 75% of migrants had no conviction whatsoever. Only about 900 even had a drug-related offense, so, you know, less than 1% overall. Most of them, as you point out, so 75% don't have any conviction at all. Of those convictions that are sort of top of the list, you know, below that, are, you know, two of them are immigration related. It's illegal entry and illegal reentry, and also charges for driving infractions. So it kind of gives you an idea that, you know, this is the best data that we could have. If people have serious criminal convictions and criminal records, this is where probably where we would find them, would be among people who have been deported. And again, the data just shows that it's not that significant, at least in terms of a overall percentage.
We dedicated a whole hour last week to asylum and the process of seeking asylum here in the United States. And we found that, yeah, between 75 and 80% of people who seek asylum are not granted asylum. So logic would then track that you could have not committed any crime in the United States and still get deported because you don't meet the legal definition of asylum.
Absolutely. And this is actually maybe one of the most important things that I think anyone coming to this topic can understand. Or should understand is that being deportable or getting deported has in some ways very little to do with the criminal justice system in this way. Conflating those issues, unfortunately, sort of muddies the waters here. And, you know, the fact is that there are people who have been living here for years and years and years and have families and are part of the community and maybe have never lived outside the United States. And they end up getting deported because of some minor paperwork, administrative thing, some other reason that may even be in the past, whereas some people who are recent arrivals and qualify for asylum can say. So it's not always a system that makes a lot of sense in terms of the outcomes based on what you know about the stories of the individuals. But you're right, a lot of people who come, including people seeking asylum, don't get asylum. This is 10 years ago, this question of asylum was just not nearly as big or politicized. But really, I would say one of the main changes that we've seen in the immigration system in the last decade and a half is a real shift from labor migration to humanitarian migration. So it's really become a really main issue. And I should just say kind of as a final note here, even people who don't get asylum, they may not be deported right away. More people get deportation orders than are effectively deported in any given year. But to the extent that they may stay in the United States temporarily or longer term, they are living in a state of tremendous vulnerability, possibly unable to work, constantly, you know, facing fear of deportation and that kind of thing. So asylum is, you know, a really important topic to understand.
And we did talk about it last week, but I do want to ask you, as somebody who studies the immigration court system and all of the data, the number of people, the number of backlog of cases keeps growing and growing and growing. It looks like a black diamond mountain if you look at the way it's charted in a graph. How big of a deal is it that this backlog of cases seems to be growing exponentially year after year?
Sure. So it's become a more politicized topic. And I'll hear a couple of ways to think about this growing backlog. It is absolutely true that the backlog has grown at a really rapid rate over the past many years. There's more pending deportation cases in some individual immigration courts like Miami and New York than there were in the entire backlog 7 or 8 years ago. The consequences of this are significant. Just practically. One, it does put a lot of pressure on the system itself, just having that much workload. Second, it does create longer and longer wait times for cases. That's not usually really good news for immigrants themselves. Some amount of delay, you know, a year or two might be useful in terms of allowing people to have time to get an attorney and to find money to pay an attorney to get someone to help them with that. But long delays can be frustrating. The nature of their asylum cases themselves might change. So it's actually not unusual for immigrants to have applied for asylum. And then by the time their case is actually concluded, those conditions have radically changed. Or the policy landscape has dramatically changed as it has from Obama to Trump to Biden. So those long delays are a problem. Third, just in terms of the workload of both immigration judges, but also private immigration attorneys, it's really hard to keep up. There aren't enough judges. And frankly, what we've seen in the data is there's not enough private immigration attorneys. We've seen representation rates decline dramatically from about 60% overall to about 30% in the past 5 years, which means there's not even enough attorneys to take on all the clients who need it. Now, these are sort of institutional consequences. I think there are also political consequences of this as well, in terms of it seems to be fuel for the fire for people to suggest that we should just close the border because we can't handle the number of cases coming in. And it certainly is a lot of cases coming in. At the same time, I always encourage people to remember that immigration doesn't start at our border. We have immigration in the first place because of, globally speaking, because of geopolitical instability, economic inequality, and ecological catastrophe, climate change, and so forth. And so those driving factors are unlikely to simply disappear just because we may want to change the policies of the United States. And so I think the one appropriate analogy here is, yes, the backlog is growing dramatically. It's really hard to keep up with, but you wouldn't close an emergency room at a hospital because the line outside got longer. You would try to create systemic change that allowed you to meet the needs of the people who need it. And I think that's an important way to think about it. But I think that above all, solving the problem of the backlog and all of the pending cases and getting, cases resolved in a timely and fair fashion is something that takes everyone sort of on both sides of the aisle to come together and agree that this is a problem we need to solve responsibly, rather than just sort of use it to sensationalize and polarize the discourse.
That was Austin Coker, a geographer at Syracuse University who studies immigration enforcement. Thank you for your time this morning.
Thank you for having me.
Coming up, we're untangling the economic impacts of immigration. That's when Untangled continues on 89.7 NPR News.
At Shortwave Space Camp, we escape our everyday lives to explore the mysteries and quirks of the universe. We find weird, fun, interesting stories that explain how the cosmos is partying all around us. From stars to dwarf planets to black holes and beyond, we've got you. Listen now to the Shortwave podcast from NPR.
You're listening to Untangled, a show from WOSU and All Sides that takes a complicated topic and untangles it for you. I'm your host, Anna Staber. One of the common claims about migrants crossing the border is that they're taking American jobs.
His big kill on the black people is the millions of people that he's allowed to come in through the border. They're taking black jobs now, and it could be 18, it could be 19 and even 20 million people. They're taking black jobs and they're taking Hispanic jobs. And you haven't seen it yet, but you're going to see something that's going to be the worst in our history.
We wanted to unpack that claim, learn what kinds of jobs immigrants take here in Ohio. And we decided to start with farm workers. We asked the Ohio Farm Bureau if we could talk to someone who brings in Central Americans on those temporary agricultural visas. They connected us with Cameron Way, the owner of Way Farms in Waverly, Ohio. He's been hiring a handful of Mexican men through the H-2A visa program for the last 4 years.
We had to pay for them to get here. We had to pay for them to go home. We had to pay for their housing. And then any vehicle that they, if they have, they're able to drive in the United States, then you can provide them a vehicle to drive. And that way we don't have to transport them.
Do you also have to pay at least minimum wage? Because I'm like starting to add this all
no,
up in my head.
No, they have the Department of Labor every year assesses, and they call it a prevailing wage. It's an adverse wage effect or something like that's what it's called. But so they set for every state in the United States, they set a wage, and this year it's $18.18 an hour. So when we first started, it was $15.15 or something like that 4 years ago, and it's gone up basically $3 in 4 years.
So you pay them $18 an hour, and they get room and board.
$18.18. Then we got to pay the company.
That does all the paperwork for you.
Yeah. Yeah.
So why not just hire people here?
Well, if we could, we would. That's the reason why we went to migrant labor. You can't find any. I won't say you can't find any local people that want to work, but reliable people that want to come out and work in the sun, work 50, 60 hours a week and be here every day, potentially 7 days a week if we're working 7 days a week. And, it's not easy work. It's hot. It's heavy lifting. It's everything. 20 years ago, we didn't have a problem finding high school kids that wanted to work Now we don't, you know, you can't. We used to have all, we used to have 10, 15 kids this summer ask, you know, apply for wanting to work and come and work. And now you don't get that. It's, if you get one kid a year, it's lucky.
I gotcha. So even though it's arguably listening to all the hoops you have to jump through, it's arguably more expensive for you to go find these visa workers.
It is, but it's a piece of mind. I can guarantee you this. We couldn't do what we are doing right now without them.
The guys that you have come out for the season, they're pretty reliable?
Oh, yeah. I mean, they don't have, you know, they're here every day. They want to work as many hours as they can work, and, you know, they'll work all day long, and you don't have to worry about what they're doing. They're healthy 99% of the time. I don't think – we've only had one of the guys call off a day that didn't – he didn't feel good, and he didn't come into work. And it's been one day out of 4 years, so –
That's dedication for sure.
It is. It is. I mean, we treat our guys like family. I mean, we take them out to dinner. We, you know, we'll take them on a weekend. You know, we'll take them, you know, take them swimming, or we took them to Kings Island one day last year. We'll take them to baseball games, whatever they want to do.
Oh, so it's the same guys coming back year after year after year.
Yeah, we request them. It costs more money to do that, but it's peace of mind knowing that, you know, when your guys come here, you don't have to train them every year.
Joining me now to unpack how immigrants impact our economy is Alex Narasta, Vice President for Economic and Social Policy Studies at the Cato Institute. Welcome to Untangled, Alex.
Thanks for having me.
So Cameron Way, the farmer we just heard from, says he hires immigrant agricultural workers because he can't find locals willing to do the work. How common would you say Cameron's story is?
It's very common. It's practically ubiquitous across many sectors of the U.S. economy. And the major reason is American kids have other options, many other options. When I was in high school 20 some years ago, I worked in a movie theater, which was much more pleasant than working in the farms near my house in Southern California. Then I worked in a women's shoe store. And today, native-born American kids have so many more options, and that doesn't even count things like test preparation for the SATs, or taking summer classes, or the myriad leisure and fun opportunities that are out there today. So what that gentleman talked about is actually probably more of an extreme problem than he makes it out to be.
The bigger question, though, is whether thousands of new arrivals hurt American workers. This is one of the main arguments of Trump's presidential campaign, that migrants are not only dangerous, they're bad for the labor market. I want to unpack that with you and go through some of the claims that former President Trump makes. So this first one is a quote from a rally in Nevada. Trump says virtually 100% of the new jobs under Biden have gone to illegal aliens. True or false?
Totally false. Demonstrably false. Insanely false. Now, of course, a percentage of the new jobs have gone to immigrants who have recently arrived in the United States. That's certainly true. A good amount of them have gone to the foreign-born population, but that's because the foreign-born worker-age population is actually growing, and the native-born American worker-age population is stable or shrinking, depending on the age cohort, because fertility has been low for a long time in the U.S. The upcoming generations are about the same size or even smaller than the generations they're replacing. So you're getting a higher percentage of labor force growth going to foreign-born people, going to immigrants. But that's merely because there are more of them and fewer native-born Americans, relatively.
When it comes to the big picture question of how foreigners impact the labor market, it's a bit more complicated. Economists have been arguing about this for decades. One theory is labor markets follow the rules of supply and demand. New immigrants add to the supply, that lowers demand. Therefore, immigrants increase unemployment while lowering wages for Americans. It's the argument that is pushed most commonly by George Borjas, a Cuban-American researcher at Harvard. So what do you make of the supply and demand argument with immigrants?
Well, supply and demand argument is correct, but people only stop this line of argument after mentioning demand most of the time, after mentioning supply most of the time. So it's true, supply of workers goes up, but the demand for jobs also goes up. Immigrants are people, immigrants buy things and services. And as a result of that increased demand, there are more jobs created in the U.S. economy. I mean, the notion that more people will reduce the amount of jobs is something that economists used to call the lump of labor fallacy. It is the idea that there was a certain set amount of work in the economy, and that work needs to be done no matter what. But that's just fallacious. We all know there are so many things that could be done if there were more workers, and so many fewer things that would be done if there were fewer workers. The farmer, I think, is a great example of this. If he were confined to only hiring native-born Americans, the wages would have to rise considerably. But that doesn't mean those jobs would be filled. Most likely those jobs would not be filled. The farmer would change what he is growing, and that production on his farm would disappear, and we'd all be poorer as a result.
Yeah, there was that great, it was a law in Georgia where they really restricted access migrants, and a lot of migrants left. And then the farmers themselves were the ones that were like, hey, actually, we're having a problem harvesting our crops.
That's right. And the long-term effects of that is that farmers are going to change what they grow. They're going to shift toward using machines to harvest. And there's nothing wrong with using machines to harvest, right? But it's not really a job creation program. I think my former professor, Alex Tabarrok, when talking about these jobs, these laws in the American South about a decade ago that made it very difficult to hire immigrants, especially illegal immigrants, said that they basically turned good workers into criminals, and then they tried to turn criminals into bad workers by taking people out of prisons and putting them in the fields. But the results were terrible. They didn't work, and the United States was poorer as a result. We had less food being grown here.
Our first season of Untangled was all about the housing crisis here in Central Ohio. And one of the questions that comes up that I find fascinating is whether an influx of immigrants raises the cost of housing in the cities where they live.
The results of this are actually unambiguously yes. So this is the thing. Everybody in the immigration debate focuses on the impact on jobs and the labor market. But the actual economic sector where immigrants tend to have the largest effect is actually in housing. Immigrants require a place to live like anybody else. They rent, they bid up these rents. Now, the secondary effects of this, of course, is higher prices. But those higher prices also accrue to the owners of real estate. And almost all of the owners of real estate in the United States are native-born Americans. Now, there are lots of other policies that could be done to increase the supply of housing. I favor, for instance, getting rid of or eliminating as much as possible housing and land use regulations and zonings that prevent the construction of new real estate. But it is pretty clear that immigrants do drive up the demand for real estate. And because we can't build new housing as much as we would ideally be able to in a free market, the prices do increase. And that does accrue to the benefit of native-born American owners of real estate, but also raises rents for those of us who do not own real estate.
What about public benefits? That's one of the things we hear a lot, that immigrants, both legal and illegal immigrants, are on welfare, essentially.
So when we take a look at this data, there's a few things that show up. One is that immigrants consume less welfare benefits, fewer welfare benefits than native-born Americans by a pretty good amount, about 28% less per capita. And part of the reason for that is, of course, that new immigrants have much more limited access to welfare benefits in the United States compared to native-born Americans. The other effect is because of that, partly, they have a higher labor force participation rate. They're just not as likely to be unemployed and to require or to try to consume that kind of assistance. And then there's the whole myriad other bits of public services like public schools, the roads, law enforcement, et cetera. And when you take a look at all of this, it turns out that immigrants pay in, on average, more in taxes than they consume in public benefits. And that may seem shocking to people, but let me just give you a quick way to think about it, right? When people are younger, they consume a lot of benefits, welfare, but also public school. when you're a working age, they consume a lot less, and then they retire, they consume a lot more through Social Security and Medicare. So if an immigrant comes at the age of 20 and they start working, even if they're poor, that means that the government and taxpayers didn't have to pay for their public school. So it's immediately sort of this positive payment of taxes. So you take a look at that over the tens of millions of people who are here. And on average, immigrants pay in more in taxes than they receive in public benefits.
That was Alex Narasta, Vice President for Economic and Social Policy Studies at the Cato Institute. He has some great myth-busting documentation if you ever want to take a little extra deep dive. Thank you so much for your time this morning, Alex.
Hey, thank you so much for having me.
And that'll do it for this hour of Untangled. Thanks for listening to 89.7 NPR News.